I don't make the signs. Don't blame the signs on me. They don't even ask me. Yeah. Don't read anything into the sign except that the people who make the signs have funny ideas. It's not I that make the signs. I think that people today are very split on the idea of miracles. You'll find people for whom the idea of a miracle is obvious. Why not? Open your mind, take a look around, see what's going on, and who says there shouldn't be miracles? Now you find people for whom the whole idea of miracle is just crazy. What, do you believe in miracles? You gotta be nuts. What do you mean? How can you believe in miracles? I think it's usually a good idea for somebody says he believes something one way or another to ask him what his reasons are. Instead of you trying to prove the opposite, give him a chance to express himself, see what's going on in his mind. And ask a person who doesn't believe in miracles, thinks miracles are just out of line. Why? Why have you made up your mind that there are no miracles? What leads you to think that there are no miracles? All the stories of miracles have to be false. They have to be false. Why? So, sometimes people say, well, you know, there are laws of nature, and the laws of nature are laws, and they just don't allow for any miracles to take place. And they ask him, what reasons do you have to think that there are laws like that? Laws that make things happen, laws that have no exceptions, laws that always work, that never, you know, go on holiday, laws than which there's nothing stronger. Well, why do you think that? History is pretty old, you know. Even our history goes back 6,000 years. So usually, an honest person will say, well, I've never seen any. Oh, that's it. That's the whole reason. Because you never saw any. And your experience, and you are, of course, at least 93, your experience covers the whole of the world. Because you haven't seen them, therefore they don't exist. What about whales? Have you seen whales? Most people have not. Well. But you believe whales exist? I say, well, because other people saw them. Right. Other people saw them, and they told us about them. Well, there are other people who say they saw miracles, too. So why, when this group says they saw whales, they go, good. So they saw whales. Must be whales. And when that group says they saw miracles, oh no, that can't be. Impossible. Nope, not allowing that. Not buying that. Why? Are you telling me because people made mistakes? People used to think that whales were dragons, you know. Sea dragons breathing fire. That's what they used to think. When they blew air and water vapor at the blowhole on the top of their heads, they thought that that was smoke. What is it that makes a person so negative about miracles? It can't be he knows there are laws that never have exceptions. Because he doesn't know any such thing. How would he know such a thing? Is there debate about miracles? Yes, there is debate. Not everybody agrees on what was a miracle and what wasn't a miracle. Are there debates in science? You bet. You bet. Lots of debates. That doesn't mean the whole thing is a fraud. It just means that some of them are difficult. Some of them are controversial. Now, like I mentioned last night. I think there is a slide here. There's a slide, and people go down this slide without even noticing it. Scientists are among the first people down the slide. You start with science, whose job is to find natural explanations for things. Explanations within nature. That's a job. It's a job like any other job, you know. That the people who watch the economy, and there are people who are psychologists, people who collect garbage, and there are people who try to figure out why things blow up, or why certain medicines work, or why certain diseases function the way they function, or just try to figure these things out. But they operate under a self-imposed limitation. We're only going to accept natural causes. Natural causes, and we're going to discover them, inspect them with a natural investigation. Why? Why are you restricting yourself in that way? So, at the beginning, the honest person says, because that's what I do. That's my job. You want to do it some other way? The door is open. Just, I don't do that. That's fine. That's fine. Each person, each profession has the right to define what it's going to do and try to figure out how things work from its point of view, making whatever assumptions it wants to make. But that doesn't mean that's all there is. It's just because they've chosen to make that assumption. I'll tell you how I got into philosophy. If you do mathematics, almost all the mathematics works like this. You have axioms, and you're trying to prove theorems. Trying to prove things. Take your axioms and try to figure out some argument that makes you get to the conclusion that such and such is true. You take a working mathematician and ask him, how did you pick these axioms? Why don't you pick different axioms? Add some axioms, subtract some axioms. He'll say, listen, I'm sure it's an interesting question for philosophers. But that's not a question for mathematicians. Mathematicians don't do that. They take the axioms we have, we try to prove theorems. That's our job. Somebody else is interested in it. Why it is that way. You see, I never like to take anything for granted. It was in my nature. So when they said, we just take the axioms for granted, I said, okay, that's not where I want to be. I don't want to take anything for granted. Science operates according to certain methods, certain types of deductions and experimentation and the rest. I have a friend who got into philosophy of science in the following way. He was taking physics in college, and one of the things they had to do was do an experiment that was in the book. Reproduce the experiment. So as he was doing it, he thought to himself, suppose I get a result that's different from the book. What will happen? They'll tell me I did the experiment wrong. So am I confirming the book? No. The book already is a standard by which I'm judged. It's impossible to criticize the book. Because if you get something different from the book, that proves you didn't do it right. Not that the book is wrong. So who's supporting who here? What's based on what? The scientist doesn't ask that question. He just does it by the book. He applies the method and he follows it, usually. But as a philosopher, as a person, I just didn't want to take anything for granted. That's not to say there's something wrong with a scientist who's doing an experiment. That's his job. My job was to figure out why we do it this way rather than some other way. Why not use a different method altogether? If each person recognizes that he's chosen a profession, and that profession works within certain limits, that's fine, as long as it leaves room for other professions. But when a person says, science has chosen, now science becomes with a capital S, see? Science has chosen to operate looking for natural causes. Therefore, there are only natural causes. Then he has gone down the slide. Instead of just saying, this is what we do because that's what we do. But other people can do other things. He now has become an imperialist. And he said, what I do is everything. There is nothing else. And if you do things differently, you're definitely doing it wrong.
medical, though, medicine, though, that they have people fix them, they say medicine can't explain this, or science can't explain this, it's out of the norm. And even within the profession, they admit that sometimes if someone gets healed when they weren't supposed to. So they're actually saying that it's we don't understand because we follow the guideline of experiments, and this is the way it should occur, and it didn't occur this way, it's outside the norm. So they actually are saying it might be outside nature. And
now you're heading on. Up to here you said correctly. They will say, according to the way we have our theory working, this doesn't fit. But the solution's got to be a better theory about what's going on in nature. Never do they say, and therefore it might be God. That's not
true.
No,
bankruptcy.
No, because that's an admission of bankruptcy. I mean, you may find some scientists who are religious who know, they switch hats at that point, and they say, you know, but as scientists, you won't find that. You won't find it, yeah.
Some of those are scientists when they operate, you know, trying to find physical explanations, and you know, the idea that you can always come up with a better theory, you never really can necessarily conclude that it's outside nature. You only know that you don't know how it works, even if it will be.
Well, let's take it. This is a good point. Let's take it in two steps. First of all, let's take the step that it's outside the theory we've got. And after you take the step, it's outside the theory we've got, then you can ask, well, then look at the kind of thing it is and see how likely it is you're going to cook up another theory similar to the ones we've got that'll do the job. What I want to show you is that there are times when something happens and you don't say, oh, well, I'll just think up another explanation within the theory I've got, but you're willing to go a big step out. Now, I'll give you two examples, one for physics and one for psychology. Let's start with psychology, because you're more familiar with this. There are people who have all sorts of problems. The people who have to wash 103 times before they go to bed. Washing compulsions. There are people who can't hold a job. They can't hold a job because every time they get a job, they have a fight with the boss, and they get thrown out. Now, these were mysteries. People just have these weird behaviors and they're very self-destructive. And nobody could figure out why. Along came Freud, after Israel Salanter, and without having read him, of course. And Freud said, listen, in addition to everything that you feel and everything that you think, there's also part of your mind that's underwater, drowning under there, in your unconscious. And you're not conscious of it at all. You don't know what's going on in there at all. And the reason you do these things, it's not just a nervous twitch. That part of your mind that's underwater is pushing you to do these things. And it's systematic. So it's 103 washings. Doesn't sometimes become striking matches, and sometimes mean folding laundry over and over again. It's washings. Obviously, it has something to do with your intelligence, because it takes intelligence and to wash, rather than just go to pieces on the floor. So Freud said there's an unconscious, and that produces behavior sometimes, and you don't like it because in your conscious mind what you like to do is quite wrong. This guy loses jobs. You know why? Because he has unresolved conflicts with his father. And since his father used to boss him around, when he gets a job, his employer becomes, in his mind, the father figure. And all the old unresolved conflicts with his father come to the surface, and he starts fighting with his employer because he's really still fighting with his father from childhood. He doesn't know that. Indeed, if you tell him, he'll think you're nuts. What are you talking about? I made up with my father long ago. That's on the surface. Really unconsciously. Now, why didn't people say, Freud, you're nuts? Okay, we don't have explanations. That's true. We'll get them. You're inventing an unconscious? For a while, even the words didn't make sense. I have unconscious thoughts? How can you have a thought if you're not conscious of it? Unconscious desires? I mean, for a while, the words resisted that idea. To want something means I have to know I want it. How can I want something without knowing I want it? Why didn't people say, we don't have an explanation, we'll think, well, we'll get a theory. A theory in terms of the conscious mind. Why invent an unconscious mind? Give us time. We'll manage it.
you still create a new theory within the bounds of physical.
Oh, but the question is, where do you draw the bounds? One step at a time. One step at a time. What I'm saying is, here you had something that resisted explanation for a long, long time. Somebody says, "I got a brand new idea." An unconscious mind, which for a while was almost a paradox. But when you used it, people saw that, by golly, you know, seems to do the job. And they allowed themselves to be pushed beyond it. Now let's take something else. What makes things move? Why do things move? Well, lots and lots and lots of things move because they get a push. That's true. But of course, to get a push means something else has to be moving. What starts things moving? So at a certain time, let's say around 1910, they thought there were two things that make things move. One is gravity. You let something go, it falls. Every two things in the universe are attracting each other with the force of gravity. If nothing else got in the way, everything would just clump up in a giant glob at the center. There wouldn't be a center. Okay, we know about that. The other thing that makes things move is magnetics. A magnet, take a magnet, Mr. Thompson, your kid, you know, and bring it close to the nail, and at a certain point, the nail jumps up off the table to the magnet. Very dramatic, you know, sort of resisting gravity, flying on some. So here are two things that make things move. One is gravity, and one is magnetism. Okay, now, in the early 1920s, when they were discovering the atom, and trying to figure out what the atom was made of, at a certain point, they believed that the atom has electrons running around, and in the center there's a nucleus. And the nucleus, at that time, they thought was made of protons. They didn't know about neutrons yet. Protons. Neutrons won't help, as you'll see. Protons. Okay, protons are all positively charged. It's sort of like, protons are like, each one of them is the north pole of a magnet. What happens if you put two more north poles of a magnet together? Push apart, right? And the rule for protons is the same thing. If two particles have the same charge, they push each other apart. So now, we're given a picture. In this atom, you have 26 protons sitting in the center in the nucleus. What are they doing sitting together in the center? Sitting together like charges repel. They're all positive. They should be pushing each other apart. How come they're sitting together? Now you'll say, oh, it's easy. You forgot about something. You forgot about gravity. Gravity's holding them together. And the answer will be, you forgot about the nail. What happens with the nail? You bring the magnet close, and the nail jumps up off the earth to the magnet. Now you could think of this as a tug of war. On one side, the magnet's pulling, and the other side, the whole earth is pulling. Who wins? The magnet wins. That gives you a measure of how much stronger magnets are than gravity. Magnets are much, 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 much stronger than gravity. So it ain't gravity holding the protons together in the nucleus. It just can't do the job. So why are the protons sitting together in the nucleus? You know what the answer is? A new fundamental force of nature. A third force of nature called the strong force. A brand new force discovered and invented specifically for this purpose. To explain why the protons are sitting together in the nucleus. Because otherwise you can't explain it. Now why didn't people say, give us time, give us time. We just discovered them last year. And already you're inventing new forces? Maybe gravity works differently in different levels, or maybe magnets reverse at a certain distance, or maybe you don't give us, what are you in such a hurry to invent? Because it was quite obvious that the force this strong that's going to overwhelm magnetism is so out of line with what we know already. You've got to invent something new. So they invented a new force of nature, and this new, right, that's a new force of nature. When you got inside the protons like a little bag, and inside there are three quarks. Quarks are just more little beans. So the question was this, if the proton is made up of three little beans, how come I never find any of those beans by themselves? They're always inside. He says, well, I'll tell you why. Because as the force holding the beams together is a brand new kind of force. This is, it has a different quality from every other force. Every other force in the world, the farther away you get, the weaker it gets. The force holding the quarks together is opposite. The farther away you get, the stronger it gets. That's why they're never separate. Because when you pull them further and further apart, the force between them gets stronger and stronger. At a certain point, you can't overwhelm it anymore. It's like a rubber band, you know? Start pulling your rubber band, it's very easy. But the more you pull it, the harder it gets to pull. Except with a rubber band, you can snap it. But this thing is just impossible to snap. That's why you never find free quarks. Now, they invented this different from all the other forces in the world. Because the stuff is there, you know, and it just doesn't behave the way other things behave. Indeed, Noam Chomsky, who's really a great scientific thinker, he led a whole revolution in linguistics, and he has some books on general philosophy of science. He says that the biggest revolution in the last 300 years is we don't know what physical is anymore. We used to think we knew what physical things are. But the fundamental properties of physical things have changed so much that when people talk about the mental and the physical, or the spiritual and the physical, the big revolution is we don't know what we mean by physical anymore. We don't know what the limits of the physical are anymore. Can you reduce chemistry to physics? Yes, but only if you drastically change physics. You can't have quantum physics. It only works with quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics has very funny ideas, like, if you're not looking, it isn't there. It isn't there until you look. Baseballs don't behave like that. Ice cream cones don't behave like that. Jelly beans don't behave like that. People don't behave like that. But when you get down small enough, that's how it works. It isn't there until you look. What kind of thing is that? That's not little baseballs. It's some brand new thing that somehow knows you're looking and doesn't know and knows when you're not looking. So, beyond that, I mean, if you're inventive enough, you just expand nature to take in whatever you happen to like, so then, indeed, you know, you never get beyond nature. But you really are drastically changing the rules. You tell somebody 100 years ago that you believe that matter comes into existence out of nothing. And they send you off to the loony bin. That's not scientific. It's anti-scientific. With the Big Bang, many people believe that the whole universe came into existence out of nothing. Others, before 1965, believed that electrons are coming into existence all over the universe out of nothing all the time. So, what counts as the limits here? So you look at the way science is really done, you see that they're willing to step beyond the limits when you have something difficult to explain, and somebody thinks up an idea, and the idea explains it, then, even if it breaks the old rules, they're willing to go with it. You know, Richard Feynman, whose writings I find very wonderful in terms of explaining science, he says, he's quoting a philosopher, and the philosopher said, the bedrock of science is that when you set up an experiment and you get a result, every time you set up the same experiment, you'll get the same result. So Feynman said, if that's the bedrock of science, then there is no science, because it doesn't work that way. So Mr. Philosopher, get out of your study, open your eyes, roll up your sleeves, and find out what the world is really like. Don't dream up science in your mind. Go out and take a look at what's really going on. Now, you can set up experiments in fundamental physics with the same experimental apparatus, and the results are different every time. That's just the way the world is. It means that you don't have real laws at the bottom. At the bottom, there are things that happen randomly. Well, it wasn't supposed to be like that. Again, if you told that to people 120 years ago, they'd say that's anti-scientific. It's just that we got some very difficult experiments to explain, and the only way to explain them is something like that. So we change the rules. So, someone who says that, you know, you can't go outside the rules of nature is very naive. He's very naive. As Chomsky says, the rules of 1850 are not the rules of 1900. The rules of 1900 are the rules of 1950. And the rules of 1950 won't be the rules of 2050 either. So if someone complains you're stepping beyond nature, I think the right answer is try to drop your prejudices and try to open your eyes. Just open your eyes. A.J. Ayer, Alfred Jules Ayer, a British philosopher, who, if I remember correctly, came from a mixed marriage. I don't remember whether his father's Jewish or his mother's Jewish, but it was a mixed marriage. Wrote that if I were standing at Sinai and I had the experience of hearing God speak, I would go to the nearest psychiatrist. Because that would prove that I'm crazy. That's what you call an open-minded person. Right. He's so sure there is no God. He's so sure that there can't be a God that if he would experience it directly, he'd have to say it's a hallucination. And if it's a hallucination, I must be crazy. And he would go to a psychiatrist. A person could say the same thing about tables. I've decided there can't be any tables. So what's this? There's a hallucination. Because there can't be any tables. Now I want you to know, that's what he wrote. But I was in London maybe 10 years ago or 15 years ago when he had some kind of medical emergency, took him to the hospital, and he had a near-death experience. And he came out of it, and I interviewed him in the London Times afterwards. And he said, the bottom line in my life is that I'm an empiricist. Empiricist means keep your eyes open and see what's going on and try to figure it out. True, he said, up until now, I've been against religion and against life after death and against all of those funny ideas. But I just had an experience. And I'm an empiricist. And my job is to make sense out of what happens. And this happened. So, I have to rethink. See, here's a guy who, at one time, wrote that if he experienced God, he would think he was crazy. But when he had a really disturbing experience that didn't fit with his ideas, he did. He did stop to think that maybe something's going on. So I think the plea has to be for open-mindedness. Don't make up your mind beforehand what's going on. Just like those who felt everything must have a law that makes it happen, had to give it up for quantum mechanics, and the speed of light, and the unconscious and all the rest, just be open-minded and see what happens. Now, when I was your age and I was exploring Torah, traditional Judaism, and I became convinced that it's true, and I pledged allegiance to it, and people started to tell me about miracle stories. Stories about great rabbis or their own rabbis. I said to them, you know what, just leave me out, okay? I believe in the Exodus, I believe in the relation with Sinai, I believe in King David, I believe in the Talmud, I believe in Shalom. That's enough. Where is it written that I have to believe that your rabbi did something special? No, just leave me alone. The Torah is the Torah, and I'm accepting it. And that was my orientation for quite a few years. And people would tell me, this happened, and that happened. I said, well, if that makes you happy, no. But just leave me out. What changed my mind is when these things started happening to me. That was a little tough to take. It happened to me, it happened to very close friends of mine. I was present when they happened. And then I had to change my point of view. But only because I tried to remain open-minded, I tried to keep my eyes open, and just respond to what I see. We've been Hasidim of the Boston Rebbe, 40 years. Actually, this Purim will be 41 years for me. My wife, 38 years, 39 years. And we have a very close relationship with the Rebbe. We call him regularly, and he sometimes calls us. In the 70s, when we were living in Baltimore, one Friday morning, he called, and my wife answered the phone. And usually if he would call and reach one of us, he'd ask us how we are and what's going on. And he said to her, are you all right? And she said, yes. He asked her three times, are you all right? In a very concerned tone of voice. And she assured him that she was fine. He said, okay, have a good Shabbos. And he hung up. She told me the conversation. It was bizarre because, you know, we never had any conversation like that. Sunday morning, she had a miscarriage. Now, we know medically that if a person has a miscarriage, usually that means the fetus has been dead 36 hours, 48 hours, 56 hours, something like that. It means he called her when the life of the fetus was terminated. I mean, the life of the fetus was, it was less than 3 months, if I remember correctly. But we knew she was pregnant. It wasn't a surprise. That's the only such telephone call in 40 years. What are you going to say? He got it right by accident? If he called us up that way every month or so, it was something else. It was the only such telephone call in 40 years.
Did you ask him on it?
We told him afterwards about the miscarriage. Asked him about it. I mean, it was pretty obvious. What should we ask? Is that a question? Okay. There's a fellow in Boston. He was there even when we were there. He was a student in law school. And in the winter, he began to get pains in his chest and developed some cough. Finally, he couldn't stand anymore. He went to a doctor. The doctor said, you have a growth in your chest. It is life-threatening. You need to have it out immediately. Check into the hospital tomorrow morning. Tomorrow afternoon, I'm doing the operation. So he came to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe said, I don't like the surgeon, I don't like his diagnosis, I don't like his proposed surgery, go to another guy. And he goes to another guy. Another guy says, there is something there, but we should do a limited operation, not a radical operation. But like the Rebbe says, go with the second guy. Now you understand, the first guy says, if you don't do my operation, there's a good chance you're going to die. The Rebbe said, go with the second guy. His grandchild just had a bar mitzvah. So, he made it. We were here in 1977. I had sabbatical, and so my whole family came for 6 months. We have friends who are living in Kiryat Arba. Their three-year-old was hit. You know, people are sometimes real geniuses. They were painting some of the buildings. So you have a platform on which the painters stand to paint the walls. These are several stories high in these buildings. What do you anchor the platform with? Barrels of water on the roof. That's great. And when you finish painting the building, what do? You leave it there. I mean, you have other things to do. Fine, you leave it there, but eventually the water in the barrels evaporates. And eventually you can't hold the platform anymore. So when one of these platforms fell, our friend's three-year-old was standing below and got hit and was flattened. So much so that the people who saw it were sure she had died. And they put her in a hospital immediately to go to Hadassah Hospital. And only after the ambulance left did they tell the parents, because they didn't want the parents to see the child. Anyway, the child came to Hadassah and was in a coma. These people happened to have a relationship with the Boston Rebbe, and the Rebbe happened to be in Eretz Israel at the same time. And the doctors in Hadassah said she has sustained massive brain injury, and we don't know what to do. We really ought to operate, but we can't figure out how to operate. You know, every injury is different. You don't have patterns of injuries. And they did x-rays, and they went to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe said, don't worry, she's going to be fine. Now, here are the doctors telling you there's massive brain injury, and she needs surgery, and the Rebbe says, she's going to be fine. They even added a name, which is customary in some circles to add a name, like Chaim, for a girl, Chaya, to indicate life. The Rebbe said, I told you shouldn't do that. There's no reason for it, no need for it, she's going to be fine. After a few weeks, she regained consciousness, but had total amnesia. So, the hospital suggested take her home for Shabbos to familiar surroundings. Maybe that will jog her memory. And they took her home for Shabbos. There was a partial recovery of memory. Mostly Shabbos, Saturday night. Memory went blank again. They brought her back to the hospital. A few days later, she started running a fever. Quite high fever. And the doctor said, oh, it's brain injury. There's a center in the brain that controls the temperature of your body, and it was injured, and we really ought to operate, but to operate means we'll have to cut through healthy tissue, and we don't know how to do that. So they went to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe said, I told you, everything's going to be fine. Well, one morning, a new nurse came on the shift, took her temperature, and saw that she had a high temperature. Without looking at the chart, she gave her some antibiotics. And she did a throat culture. Turned out she had strep throat. So they gave her antibiotics for the strep throat. The strep throat went away. And over the period, the next few months, she supposedly gained her memory and became fully functional. Now, how do I know the story? Because these people who live in Kiryat Arba came, the father and the mother, to be with their daughter in the hospital, and they used to come to our apartment at night to sleep by us. So we were there. We experienced this together with them. And we heard their reports from the doctors, and we went with them to the Rebbe, and we heard what the Rebbe said, and now, you know, try it sometime. Take the doctor's reports and predict the exact opposite and see how often you're going to be right. Now, I know dozens of cases like this. We have friends who are living in Boston, and the usual practice was, a wife becomes pregnant, you ask the Rebbe for permission to tell it to people, and he usually says, the end of the third month. That's the norm. This family had several children, and each one they had said, the end of the third month. One, the end of the third month, he said, don't tell. The end of the fourth month, he said, don't tell. The end of the fifth month, she had a miscarriage. But he tells everybody the end of the third month, and he told them the end of the third month for the other children. This one he didn't say. Said differently. You go figure that out.
You hear a lot of miracle stories about, like you said, about like the Boston Rebbe, the Barbature Rebbe. I was wondering, I'm not saying like, because there are amazing stories, but do you think it's a reason to follow a particular derech?
I'll come back to that. I just want to say one more thing. We have close friends. We've been close friends with them for more than 40 years. The wife is a labor coach. And she sometimes is coaching women who have difficult, protracted labors, you know, and painful and distressing. And she said that when it gets very tough, she calls the Rebbe. And she says, I can tell you dozens of times, I've called him, and asked him to be misbound, to pray, and within a half hour there's a safe birth. Even one case where the doctor said, we're going to do a cesarean. And she said, please, let me call Boston. Give me 5 minutes to call Boston. She called 5 minutes, called Boston, and there was an immediate change, and they didn't do the cesarean. Now, she's doing this, you know, this is her profession. And she says, I know when I call Boston. I've seen it enough times to know what's going to happen. So, the only thing I believe that's very important is to be open-minded. I'm not telling you to believe this. At your age, when people told me the same stories I'm telling you, I didn't believe it either. So I'm not telling you to believe it. Just be open-minded. Don't rule it out. So that when things like that start to happen, if you should be so favored that it should start to happen, then you won't miss it. You won't miss it. Because people tend to see what they expect to see. And they don't see what's out of their mental picture. And if you have that category, you can leave the category empty. Just put the category in. So that if something like that happens, you will be able to recognize it. Now, one more story with the moral. I'm going to have to, there's a bridge to that. There was a man who lived in Pszczyzna in Poland, who was called the Yidda Kadosh, the Holy Jew. Very great person. He was once on his way someplace, and he got waylaid. It was delayed, and he couldn't get there. So he ended up spending Shabbos in an inn. There were Jewish inns at the time, and he served kosher food, and they had a minyan, you know. It was just he didn't get to where he wanted to be. So he spent the Shabbos in the inn, and then he came mostly Shabbos. He said to the innkeeper, Tell me what my bill is. I'll pay you, and then I'll go on. So the innkeeper said, you don't owe me any money. They were standing outside by the wagon. He had piled up everything on the wagon, ready to go. And the innkeeper said, I don't want anything. The fact that you were in my inn, and I saw you daven, saw the way you served God, that's enough for me. So the Yidei Kodesh said, well, at the least thing I could do is give your family a bracha. Call your family out here, and I'll give them a bracha, a blessing. Oh, what a wonderful idea. He calls to his wife, bring the children out. The wife comes out, the children come out, and the Yidei Kodesh gives each one of them a blessing, and he's about to get on the wagon to leave, and the innkeeper says, I forgot, we have another daughter upstairs. She's crippled. She couldn't come. Maybe she heard the call, but she couldn't come down. Can I go up and bring her down? So the Yidei Kodesh, according to the story, at this point was ready to go, said, okay, fine, bring her down, and I'll give her a blessing also. So as the innkeeper turned to walk back to the inn, the door to the inn opened, and the daughter walked out the door to the Yidei Kodesh to get the blessing. That's how the story is recorded, where I saw it. So I asked my Rebbe, how am I supposed to look at this? If I take the story literally, it sounds like the Yidei Kodesh didn't even know. He didn't even know that other daughter was there. It's not that he made a miracle and cured that daughter. It just happened. It's as if the miracle is following him. Not that he's doing the miracle. Not that he's causing the miracle. This isn't kosher magic. But rather, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made a miracle in his environment to let people know that he's special. To let people know that this is a person who you could elevate yourself by being associated with. And then everybody said to me that at least the philosophy is right. When great things happen through or in the vicinity of a great person, it doesn't necessarily mean that he has control, that he can do magic. But rather that, because Baruch Hu wants to confirm the idea that he's special. And that being the case, things will happen in his vicinity that won't happen elsewhere. Now, he asks quite rightly, the fact that a person is able to do things like this, is that a reason to follow him? First of all, you won't find just one person who can do these things. There are a number of people who can do these things. So, it would only mean there's a whole group. But I would say, even a person who can't do these things, that's not why you follow someone. You follow someone because this person can make you into a better Jew. He can increase your dedication to mitzvot. He can help you get better kavanah, better concentration in prayer, get control of your impulses. That's why you choose a person to be your Rebbe. And you say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu put this person in the world, gave him certain abilities, for the sake of helping Jews become better Jews. And that's why I'm attaching myself to him. So I wouldn't say that should be the reason to... It doesn't make you necessarily better than anybody else who doesn't do those things. Just that this is how he has chosen to do his service of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And then, in these stories, there's often a very very important ideas of philosophy, of understanding. There's a famous story, I think this was one of the Slonim Rebbe's. Couple were childless for many years, came to him and said, would you please pray for us to have a child? So he said, oh, you want a child? That costs 400 rubles. So they said, 400 rubles? That's like a year's wages or something. 400 rubles, Rebbe, that's just impossible. We'll never get 400 rubles. So he said, listen, you want a child? That's the cost of a child. Child costs 400 rubles. You want it? You want it. You don't want it? You don't want it. You know, can't help you. So they pleaded with him and begged him, and he said, look, the price is 400 rubles. Take it or leave it. So they turned their backs and started to walk out in despair. At the doorway, the wife says to the husband, look, he's not willing to help us. So I guess we'll just have to daven for ourselves. When he heard that, he called them back, and he said, What did you think? You think this is a baby store? You know, you come here and then and I deliver babies and just to provide you with babies? Of course you have to stop them for yourself. Of course you have to start. I'll help. I'll help. But you have to understand that you have to be the... So, we seen 3-4 years ago, there's a couple in Harnoff. We live in Harnoff. A block from us, living a block from us. No children for 16 years. They were writing a new Sefer Torah in Imre Shefer, which is shul up the block. And they were selling partios. You know, you can donate some money, and then a certain section of the Torah is dedicated in your name. Not that it's written there, but you're given credit for buying that part. They wanted the part in Genesis where it says that Sarah finally had a child. Hashem pokad asor. So they went and applied for it. They were told it's already been sold. But Parshas Tazria, which does talk about women becoming pregnant and having a son and so forth and so on, that was unsold. So they bought that. The next year, in Parshas Tazria, they had a child. A son who had a bris. Now go calculate that. They live up the block, you know. This is not something from 400 years ago in Poland, which is, of course, the ends of the earth. This is right here in Harnoff, about a mile and a half from here. So, you know, when you see things like that happening, if your eyes are open, then you appreciate these things. If you're blinded by a false ideology or false picture of science, then you have scales over your eyes. You're not going to see it. You know, it could walk up and be right in your face if you want to see it. You have to try to open your eyes. Questions?
The question is not completely foreign, but if science were to basically redefine what nature is, which you seem to be saying that in a way they're already doing, so I guess it turns into a different animal, but it would still be able to encompass everything. If it...
Well, Oshigen Oshalo, you know, I think your eyes should be open. You know, there are two attitudes towards science that I meet nowadays, which I find both of them mystifying. One is, science has already solved all problems. That's just dumb. Then, you have people who say, science will never solve all problems, because every time you solve something, you learn something new, and the new thing has its own problems, so on and so on. I don't know why that has to be. True, up until now, every time we got a new piece of information, a new theory, there were other things that were, you know, loose ends that weren't tied together. Must it be that science will never finish? I don't know. Why don't we just wait and see? Why must we make up our minds now what's going to happen in the future? Just wait and see. So you are optimistic for science and say, well, they'll redefine science, it'll bring everything in, and won't be need for anything else. I don't know. They haven't done it yet. Why don't we just
possible?
Well, if you know the word "possible," that's one of those words that has at least a dozen meanings. If by "possible" you mean we don't know now that it can't happen, and the word "possible" is just a confession of ignorance, I agree with you. We are ignorant. If you mean it's we have good evidence that it's possible, we don't have anything of the kind. What we have is unsolved problems, and we don't know where they will go.
I don't mean that it's going to solve all problems. You're saying that. I mean, we began talking about the limitations of science, and that it only works within the natural possibilities, which is what it does. But if you redefine the role of science and you open it,
if the word nature becomes so fluid that anything can be included, so then I don't mind. Then that's just a word that doesn't carry any commitment at all. It doesn't exclude anything at all. I think Chomsky's point should be well taken. We really don't know what counts as science anymore. We don't know what counts as nature anymore. We don't know what counts as physical anymore. The principles we use today, if you would propose them 120 years ago to scientists, they would say, you're nuts. They'd say, it's not science. What? Things that happen for no reason. They happen for no reason. Nothing makes them happen. What would the scientists 120 years ago say about that? is you've abandoned science. No reason? The job of science is to find reasons. Well, we know there aren't any reasons. Oh, you do you? Well, listen, you know there aren't any reasons, then go do poetry or something. Don't go do science. The job of science is to find reasons. Well, the kosher scientist today will tell you, we know there are no reasons. We know there can't be any reasons for certain things that happen.
Within the physical realm.
You take a radioactive atom. After a certain amount of time, it breaks up. Right? The nucleus breaks up. And you have fragments that fly off. In what direction will the fragments fly off? Officially, it's random. There's nothing that determines what direction. So says Murray Gell-Mann in his famous book, The Quark and the Jaguar. Right? It's a totally random process. The half-life. A free neutron will spontaneously decay into a proton, an electron, and a neutrino. How long will it take? Nothing determines exactly how long it's going to take. There's a half-life. After a certain amount of time, half will be gone. After that amount of time, again, another half will be gone. But more than that, no one can say. What makes a particular neutron go at a particular time? The official answer is nothing. So, you would say something like that to a scientist 120 years ago, and he would say, that's not science, period, because by definition, science means finding causes that make things happen. Well, it doesn't anymore. It doesn't mean that anymore, because we sort of discovered that there aren't any in this case.
What shall we call it?
Just opening your eyes. This is what Chomsky says. You open your eyes and make the best of what you can find. Don't talk, he says, don't talk about reducing one realm to another. That's old hat. That's old fashioned. Build each realm in the way that realm will be best described and best explained, and then with an open mind, explore the relationships between the realms. Maybe you'll be able to relate them and relate them in different and interesting ways, and maybe you won't. But don't start with a prejudice. I'm not going to do anything in chemistry until I can find an explanation in physics. Why? It might be right. The chemical thing might be right. And you might discover there's something wrong with your physics. And then you might have to revolutionize your physics, which is what they had to do in quantum mechanics to be able to explain chemistry. Without quantum mechanics, you can't explain chemistry. And quantum mechanics means you got a different physics. Just open your mind and look at the world the way it is and take each thing in its own, on its own basis. Do the best you can to describe and explain it. And then when you've done a reasonable job on its own level, systematically explore how it's related to other levels. Okay.